Street Ramblers, who do some early jazz. They actually came out of a class at Parkland. Jordan Kay used to do radio here before he moved to Nashville. Well, he did do radio here. And they cut that program. They cut a lot of stuff out at Parkland. They used to have two big bands out there. Now they barely have one. So a lot of cutbacks. I was just thinking about another thing we have to thank the Clinton, or William Jefferson Clinton's administration, was the Home Act, which, contrary to what it sounds like, I believe that's what it was called. It did away with the provision in federal funding that whenever one unit of housing was taken down, another unit would supplant it, and so there'd be no erosion of the subsidized housing base. I found out that Skelton Place is looks like to me it's being gentrified. I haven't gotten all the stories on it yet, but they're offering vouchers for people to leave. And I'm suspicious. They probably have this. That's the carrot. The stick is probably the threat of increased rents. So I'm not sure if that's really going down. But they don't have to replace the units if they do sell off that property. They can just say we'll put some money into Section 8 or whatever. Give people vouchers.
Is that located? Is that the one in Urbana?
No, that's on like 2nd and Springfield.
Yeah.
It overlooks that what looks like a nice water feature now. I tried to find a News Gazette article on it, and the only article they had that mentioned Skelton Place was the one about the wildlife that are in that detention pond. There's got to be a better name for calling it. It's a little wetland, since this used to be a big swamp on the top of a rise here. Well, we're at on the top of four watersheds here. Water drains in four different directions from Champaign, but it was it's kind of a concave, so it was swampy. And Big Grove was there because that's where the trees were. That was the original name of. Well, I'm doing this New Orleans New Year's Eve reflection nostalgia sort of. Don't call it nostalgia, and that's not what this is either. But here's this tune, Fats Waller, Andy Razoff. From Trad Jazz Orchestra, and they're playing for free at 6 to 8 at the Esquire in downtown Champaign tonight.
Oh, that's your spot, Robert.
Yeah, come on out.
Okay.
Dance a lick.
Tonight. Oh, yeah. Robert, you all dance together.
There you go. Get some photographs. Put that live on Facebook.
Thank you.
Well, we'll fade out on Morgan Powell's trombone solo there. Barry Wagner on vocals. That's a great tune, Black and Blue. I don't know if they'll do it tonight. It's kind of a ballad, and it'll probably be pretty raucous at the Esquire between, is it 5 and 8? I thought I remember it was being 3 hours. I don't know when they're kicking it off. Let's get to some stuff. Black Agenda Report folks took the day off. They have their hour show up, and I was thinking about excerpting something, but I'm going to play some Mumia Abu-Jamal instead. Then we'll get to the regular feature. Amy Goodman's breaking the sound barrier. She's talking about saber rattling on Twitter. Yeah. But I've got something from a spook. This is this fellow whose name is Nixon, who's the guy that interviewed Saddam Hussein. He's getting a fair amount of press. He was on Weekend Edition today. And one of the pull-out lines for the interview was, and why you should listen to the CIA now anyway, even if they had it so wrong then. My man Dennis Bernstein of Flashpoints got together with Robert Perry of Consortium News on the latest saber rattling on about the Rusky spying. Pretty persuaded that it looks likely that it was a leak of some kind, whether it was into a Dropbox, Expose Facts, or WikiLeaks from a disgruntled DNC staffer. That was the initial leak. And then there's an allegation that it was actually an intelligence surveillance of Podesta that actually leaked. But I don't know. They're talking about how it was a fishing expedition, and he was invited to securitize his email by changing his password, which is good to do, and I don't do it enough, but anyway. And they caught him that way, supposedly, but I don't know. That could be anybody, obviously. There's still no really hard evidence, and they've already telegraphed the idea that they can't really give the real evidence because it would compromise methods and et cetera, however the CIA formula goes. So Robert Perry, with a dissident point of view, a little Samsadot on your radio. And I think that'll pretty much fill it up. Maybe we'll hear a little bit about the FCC and the Trump appointments with the guy from freepress.net. I was thinking about playing that last week. I don't know. I mean to go to freepress.net and see if there's an easy link for you to find that from. Again, that's another KPFA product. First, listener-supported, first major FM station, actually, in the country in some ways. They were at the forefront, giving out FM radios in the early days in the Bay Area. And they don't take any underwriting, actually. They are completely listener-supported. I don't know if they're going to have to revisit that. They've been having some funding problems, as everyone does. They had their community service grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting pulled as well. I don't know if they ever got some of that back or not. Anyway, here's Mumia. I wasn't down with the Dap Kings, but I know Margaret Kimberly, who writes for Black Agenda Report, was really a big fan and was crestfallen when she passed. He's commemorating some gone musical heroes. We'll get to some early jazz. Well, this is more of a standard that the early jazz, generally early jazz group, Church Street Ramblers, large local group plays. Support live and local music, indeed. Support live and local media as well. And, here's Mumia Abu-Jamal. And then we'll get to Amy Goodman as well, Breaking the Sound Barrier, her weekly column essay. It's better to hear than to read, though it is syndicated in some publications around the country. Not a whole lot, I don't think. Not like Thomas Friedman. but don't get me started.
The magic of black music. As the deaths of two musicians recently demonstrates, black music is an art form that radiates freedom, and that radiation flows around the world. The death of Sharon Jones, lead singer for the Dap Kings, is of course tragic, in that she died of cancer at a relatively young age of 60. Yet her very being was a celebration of a stellar life force. A woman once told she was too black, too short, and too fat to become a performer, did just that, and thrilled the hearts, ears, and souls of millions. In their horn-heavy, down-home standard, 100 Days, 100 Nights, Sharon Jones sings a lesson learned of a lover, a hard lesson, to pay attention to whom you lend your heart. Her determination led her to ignore agents and record producers and allowed her to set the stage afire with her blazing spirit. She freed herself and those she blessed with her voice and her powerful dark presence. Across the Atlantic, a Brit of Greek parentage did his own share of lighting the stage afire. Born Georgios Panayiotou in 1963 in East Finchley, North London, England, he became world famous as George Michael of Wham. Like many young Brits of his generation, simply read Boy George, for example, the beats, rhythms, and blues of black music struck their ears and moved them. These artists, raised on Motown sounds, constructed musics based on that dark ore and found fame and fortune. I think what they heard and what they found in black music was precisely what black musicians seeded it with, a yearning for freedom. For it was in the magical realm of music that black folks found their closest vision of freedom, to be, to become themselves. That energy was infectious and touched hearts and souls worldwide. Jazz soars in France, in Poland, in Japan. Rap has a deep foothold in London, in Paris, in Tokyo, in Soweto, in Harare, in Berlin, in Marseille, in every city where there are those who are oppressed. George Michael mixed black beats to fuel his pop hits and often used black producers and black musicians to enrich his work. When he came out as gay, he may have shocked the media, but it could be sensed in the subtexts of his songs and felt in his frenetic beats. Black musical beats and rhythms liberated him, freed him to be his self, because in black music, one finds that yearning for freedom. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
What was that? Yeah. I didn't credit Barry Wagner on vocals on that Black and Blue tune. And he also plays trombone. So I think they had two trombones that night. Dan Anderson's on the tuba there, but maybe he's got a gig with the Chicago Symphony for New Year's Eve or something like that. And Armin Baudouin of Almost A and Ms. M and the Jokers is going to be holding forth again. I better show up, don't you think? Amy Goodman. I actually haven't previewed this one, not very closely anyway. I ran it through to make sure it goes to the end, because in the past there have been one occasion where there was an interruption. And I guess I should know, but this is a regular feature. Don't have election protection report. I guess they didn't do one this week. Greg Palast has got the blues. He's pretty downcast about not being able to break through with his election theft allegations. Can't do that. We got to find somebody else to blame. There's a lot of blame to go around, but I think more of it's voter suppression and voter theft and disqualification. As he said, they weren't trying to do a recount in Michigan. They were trying to count some 70,000 votes for the first time. Greg Palast, P-A-L-A-S-T. And here's Amy Goodman. He actually gave that last footage, the Michigan report, to Democracy Now! Generally, I guess he they might say something about Democracy Now! Right now as well, on their budget. All right, here's Amy.
The global threat of Donald Trump's new nuclear instability. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. President-elect Donald Trump exploded a half century of U.S. nuclear arms policy in a single tweet last week. He wrote, "The United States must greatly strengthen and expand its nuclear capability until such time as the world comes to its senses regarding nukes," unquote. With that one vague message, Donald Trump, who hasn't even taken office yet, may have started a new arms race. Trump's statement set off alarms around the world, necessitating a cadre of his inner circle to flood the airwaves with now routine attempts to explain what their boss really meant. On MSNBC, Rachel Maddow confronted former Trump campaign manager, the newly appointed Trump counselor, Kellyanne Conway, about the shocking tweet.
He's saying we're going to expand our nuclear capability.
He's not necessarily saying that.
He did literally say we need to expand our nuclear capability.
What he's saying is we need to expand our nuclear capability, really our nuclear readiness or our capability to be ready for those who also have nuclear weapons.
The next morning during a commercial break on the MSNBC program Morning Joe, Trump spoke by phone with Mika Brzezinski as she and her co-host Joe Scarborough sat in pajamas on the Christmas-themed TV set. The call was not broadcast, but when the show came back from break, Brzezinski quoted Trump as saying, "Let it be an arms race. We will outmatch them at every pass and outlast them all," she said he told her. Minutes after that aired, Annie Leonard, executive director of Greenpeace USA, told us on the Democracy Now! NewsHour,
"Every day Trump says something that makes us worried, but this may be the most terrifying yet. A nuclear arms race is the last thing that the world needs. I think about climate change. I think about economic inequality. I think about all of these major threats that we're facing as a country and as a world. Why would we add on top of that a totally manufactured, unnecessary threat?"
President Barack Obama delivered his first address on the U.S. nuclear arsenal on April 5th, 2009, in Prague.
"Today, the Cold War has disappeared, but thousands of those weapons have not. In a strange turn of history, the threat of global nuclear war has gone down, but the risk of a nuclear attack has gone up. More nations have acquired these weapons."
Then in 2016, President Obama proposed a 30-year, $1 trillion nuclear arsenal modernization program. When asked about Obama's record, Annie Leonard told us,
"Greenpeace and many of our allies, we fought against President Obama's military spending, and we will fight against President Trump's military spending."
While President Obama's nuclear spending continues what Albert Einstein called in 1946 the drift toward unparalleled catastrophe, it still adheres to the current in-force nuclear reduction treaty between the U.S. and Russia called New START. This calls for the reduction in the number of warheads in both nations' stockpiles from the current amount of roughly 7,000 warheads each to 1,550 warheads each by February 2018. Donald Trump's declarations suggest he would scrap New START and relaunch a new nuclear arms race between the U.S. and Russia. This, in turn, could easily trigger the desire among other existing nuclear states like India, Pakistan, and Israel to increase their stockpiles. Trump also repeatedly stated throughout the presidential campaign that he supports the acquisition of nuclear weapons by other nations, including Japan, South Korea, and Saudi Arabia. And he said the opposite on other occasions, which only highlights the volatility and unpredictability of this incoming commander-in-chief. In such an unstable world, with an increasing number of nuclear weapons, the likelihood only increases that someone somewhere will hit the button. Alarmed at the recent developments, one group has launched a petition urging the current president to take action.
So there is something that President Obama can do about this to buy us some time. He can end the Cold War practice of keeping our nuclear missiles on high alert, ready to launch in a few minutes' notice. This is something that he pledged to do when he was campaigning, said he would do it when he took office, never did it. He's got 22 days to try and correct that mistake.
That's Joe Cirincione, president of the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation.
In 22 days, Donald Trump will be able to launch nuclear missiles as quickly as he now tweets. 4 minutes after he gives the order, those missiles will fly. No one can stop him. No one can reverse those launches.
Yes, President Obama should take the weapons off high alert, but that's not enough. Donald Trump's finger on the nuclear trigger is a terrifying prospect. It's the anti-nuclear movement that needs to go on high alert to make sure that trigger never gets pulled. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
And I was looking at Matt Taibbi's latest writing in Rolling Stone, something about the Russia story stinks. I commented on when I posted it on Facebook, and I was going to review that a little bit. He was publishing with Exile, which was expats, not to call them immigrants to Russia, U.S. people during the larcenous Yeltsin-Clinton decade, and reported a lot on the rise of the oligarchs and some on the connections with America, U.S. and European banks. There's a Mellon Bank of New York, I think it's called, that has a lot in Eastern Europe. They got a lot of, can't call it largesse. They were in on the pillage, the Yeltsin pillage. But something I bring up every now and again, my assessment of Putin is he is a thug and he is monstrous for democracy, but he's most popular because of the wrong-headed encirclement of Russia, U.S., and NATO. And there's a characterization of Russia, and particularly under Putin, as being aggressive about territory. And if you look closer at the details of both Georgia and Ukraine, at the time, contemporaneous with sort of the McCain election presidential campaign, he and his advisors were going on about Georgia. And it struck me as incredibly ironic that he was calling for territorial integrity of Georgia that was established by the dictator Joseph Stalin. Stalin was a Georgian by ethnicity, grew up there. And he gave these territories, East Ossetia and Abkhazia, to Georgia. Help them in their access to the Black Sea, good port, and all that sort of stuff, another good port. But they had no ethnicity related to Georgia. In fact, in Abkhazia, they speak a variant of dialect of Farsi because it's a legacy of the Persian Empire. And East Ossetia is also not culturally Georgian. So it was just done by dictatorial fiat. And it's actually the same with Crimea, that Khrushchev, who was natively Ukrainian, and gave the Crimea to Ukraine. So we're agitated about that diktat of territory as well. If you look at the time when the Tsarist regime was acquiring all that territory, apparently we should give it back to the original indigenous people, right? Crimea, the people that Stalin purged out of there. But you look at the American Empire contemporaneously, we were expanding, and we should probably give California back to Mexico, right? I'm not serious, but reduction ad absurdum is fair game. Oh, it's already 24 after the hour. I certainly won't get anything about the FCC. I'm trying to get somebody to write something about that. Every now and then I search for an opinion piece. I may have to write it myself, which just taxes me terribly to think that I might do that. But that's the gist of it. Actually, probably won't even have time for the web exclusive from Democracy Now. They did a part two of the interview with this fellow that interviewed Saddam Hussein. One thing that apparently the CIA got wrong was that Saddam wasn't even running Iraq at the time. He was writing a novel and hanging out with his mistress. Had pretty much turned. That begs the question, who was actually running Iraq at the time? But some Baathists. A lot being made of his new piece. Some of it good, some of it questionable, but I think I need to read it. It's treated in a New Yorker article. I don't like to boost the New Yorker too much because I can't stand David Remnick. And I always get these Facebook invitations to subscribe to the New Yorker on a special deal. I'm not getting them anymore, and I would always write in the comments section, well, I'll subscribe when you start printing Cy Hirsch again. And the last time I tried it, my comment was blocked. So I think now they're blocking the ads entirely. I think I might be a lost cause for subscribing. But they do some great work with, I'm forgetting the author's name of that article that talks about, and I guess it's a good time to reflect. His thesis is that one of Trump's slogan was, "We don't win anymore." And he sees the imbroglio of the Iraqi attack under Bush and Cheney, or Cheney and Bush, as counted as a loss. And it was a loss to so many people, Iraqis and wounded veterans, but certainly filled up the coffers of a lot of military contractors, etc., which is one of the things that Perry says here. How long is this Perry piece? I think we may have just go out with that and then the song from the Church Street Ramblers. Thanks for listening. We've got the locally produced show coming up at 11 o'clock, Progressive News. Was I talking about that off the air with Eunice and Robert, or on the air? I can't remember now. Here's the great Robert Perry, and they mentioned the Polk Award, but actually he won the I.F. Stone Award and was interviewed in Harvard by the journalist that does the On Point show. It's syndicated widely on public radio, but as far as I know, he's never had Perry on. It's just too bad.
The U.S. State Department declared the 35 Russian diplomats from the Washington, D.C. embassy and the consulate in San Francisco persona non grata and gave them and their families 72 hours to leave the U.S. The move follows calls from senior U.S. senators to sanction Russian officials who are believed to have played a role in the hacking, which some lawmakers referred to as America's political Pearl Harbor. Well, that's from the BBC. We are welcoming to the airwaves Robert Perry. He is the founder of ConsortiumNews.com. He's been watching various aspects of this situation very closely. Well, Bob, you wrote about it yesterday, that this could be coming, and here it is today. Your response?
Well, you know, we still haven't seen the evidence that there actually was this, both the hacking by the Russians and the leaking of the information then to WikiLeaks. There was an interesting report that was put out today. That according to the New York Times, was going to be detailing this evidence, and it was a report by the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security, but it really didn't say anything. It basically acknowledged that in terms of the key point of whether or not the Russians had provided this evidence to WikiLeaks, it says, you know, the U.S. government assesses that this information was leaked to the press and publicly disclosed. When you see a phrase like the U.S. government assesses, that really kind of means the U.S. government is guessing. But we still haven't seen any real evidence of this. And I was told by a well-placed intelligence source that while it seems pretty solid that Russian intelligence has been trying to penetrate various email accounts and other situations like that in the United States, as much as we do to them, there is a much greater doubt that the Russians were the source of the material to WikiLeaks. And we know that WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange and one of his associates, former British ambassador Craig Murray, have specifically denied that the Russians were the source of the material. Murray, who claims to have met with at least either the source or representative of one of the sources in Washington last September, says that there were two batches of information. One was from the DNC, which he claims came from a disgruntled Democrat, and the second was the information from the Podesta files. And the suggestion he's made is that came from U.S. intelligence leaker. And it turns out that that John Podesta was not just the chairman of Hillary Clinton's campaign; he was also part of the Podesta Group, which represents a number of foreign governments, including Saudi Arabia. So the idea that that U.S. intelligence would have an interest in finding out what those communications were between the Podesta Group and the Saudi government and a number of other governments would certainly make some sense. So you still have this question of actually, did the Russians not just hack into these accounts, but did they then supply the material to WikiLeaks, who then supplied it to the American people? And it also should be said that none of this information was false, as far as we know. It was all essentially accurate material. In the case of the DNC material, it related to how the DNC was tilting the playing field in favor of Hillary Clinton to sort of prevent Bernie Sanders from winning the nomination. And in the case of the Podesta files, what was released there included Hillary Clinton's speeches to Wall Street interests, which she was trying to hide from the American people, and other information about how the Clinton money machine had been engaged in sort of pay-to-play operations. So the material seems to have been not just truthful, but newsworthy. But we now have gotten into this issue of, well, did the Russians leak it to the American public? And now the Obama administration, in this effort essentially to discredit the Donald Trump election, is going to extraordinary lengths to make that the issue, not the question of what did this information actually show.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we're speaking with Robert Perry. He's the founder of ConsortiumNews.com. He's an award-winning investigative reporter who has reported for some of the major news organizations in this country and then founded Consortium some 20 years ago, won awards for his work. Bob, one has the feeling that part of this, at least in the context of what's happening with Russia and the expelling of these diplomats, it seems that Obama, part of it is very personal, that he doesn't want there to be a possibility that there could be sort of a peaceful resolution, that the United States could, in fact, cut a deal around this very bloody situation of Syria. It almost feels like sour grapes.
Well, I think President Obama has had a very complex relationship with both President Putin and Russia. For a large part of his presidency, he worked very closely with President Putin. They talked regularly. They collaborated on key issues. Putin was extremely helpful to Obama. For instance, it was Putin who got the Syrian government to surrender its stockpile of chemical weapons in 2013, which prevented Obama from going forward with his plans to bomb Syria. It was also Putin who got the Iranians to make concessions relating to their plans were on a nuclear program. But it was Russia that played a key role to achieve that diplomatic breakthrough, which is possibly the most important diplomatic move that President Obama accomplished in his 8 years. But then there was this effort, in part by the neoconservatives still inside the government, the U.S. government, to blow that relationship up, and it was blown up around Ukraine. Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland, who's a very staunch neocon and was a favorite of Secretary of State Clinton's, essentially orchestrated or helped orchestrate the push that removed elected President Viktor Yanukovych from Ukraine and set in motion this ugly civil war that Ukraine has been engaged in, and drove a wedge between President Obama and President Putin. After that, because of all the almost the hysterical propaganda that began to emerge around that issue and in attacking everything Russian, the New York Times became a virtual billboard of every anti-Russian propaganda theme that could be imagined, as did the Washington Post and other major news organizations in the United States, that Obama, instead of standing up to that, instead of firing Nuland and saying, we're not going to go that direction, he caved in. He basically went along with the neocons and the liberal hawks who wanted this new Cold War. And, of course, there's a huge momentum in Washington. I've been here since the 70s. And you can sort of see it sometimes when there are trillions of dollars at stake in military contracts and other kinds of expensive programs that can be justified by international tensions. And we've seen it on a smaller scale, really, with the war on terror, where that was a way to keep the military-industrial complex going after the first Cold War ended. But now there's this opportunity for a new Cold War and trillions of dollars more for nuclear weapons, for fancy weapon systems, for new jet fighters, for much bigger ticket items than the war on terror justified. So there's a huge momentum in Washington to stir up this new hostility toward Russia, and much of it has been based on propaganda and disinformation stemming from the U.S. State Department. But anyone who sort of questions this is then attacked and accused of being a Russian stooge and so forth. So we've seen almost not just a new Cold War, but a new McCarthyism. And in this context, we now have seen this effort to excuse what the DNC was doing in terms of sabotaging Sanders, what Hillary Clinton was doing when she was trying to hide the contents of her speeches to Wall Street. And that's being now wrapped up into this new effort to demonize Russia further. But the question for a journalist is really, well, what's the evidence? And so far, it has not been presented. And you know, just the New York Times this evening put out a report saying that they cited this FBI DHS report saying it was going to be detailing the evidence, but it doesn't. Most of the report is about how to protect your computer from malware, but to the degree that it does talk at all about this issue of who hacked what, it basically just goes back and says the U.S. government assesses that this information was leaked to the press and publicly disclosed, but there's no evidence of that. And then we see in the larger piece in the New York Times that goes along with this, the acknowledgement that a more detailed report on the intelligence will be published in the next 3 weeks, i.e. before President Obama leaves office, I guess. But then it says, though much of that detail, especially evidence collected from implants in Russian computer systems, tap conversations and spies, is expected to remain classified. In other words, the U.S. government is saying, we've also penetrated their computers, but we're not going to tell the American people what we found, because that would be, I guess, too much. So we're still being told, take this on faith. Has the CIA ever misled you on anything? And this has become now this foundational moment for an escalation of hostilities with nuclear-armed Russia. And this game is getting more and more dangerous, yet that has been almost ignored by the mainstream press. The idea that if this keeps up, and this includes not just words, it includes the United States now putting anti-ballistic missile systems in Eastern Europe, which the Russians see as direct threats to their security, and could possibly lead them to react to some false alarm in their radar systems, where they have to immediately decide whether to launch a nuclear strike against the United States. So we've moved to a very, very dangerous level, but there's still this kind of cavalier behavior on the part of the Obama administration, frankly, and the mainstream U.S. press.
And these are the times, if you will, when the corporate press, particularly the Washington Post and the New York Times, really become a very effective arm of the U.S. State Department. And in this context, it's so interesting, Bob, when you think about the amount of criticism, well-deserved, that Trump got for his relationship to right-wing America, you know, to David Duke. But David Duke is just a neo-Nazi. And we've caught, in this sort of twist of misreporting, the United States in what you call the push is really dealing with Nazis.
Well, that's right. In the case of Ukraine, the United States allied itself with neo-Nazis. There's no other way to put it. The Azov Battalion, which was an important cutting-edge part of the Ukrainian, first of all, the Maidan the protest, which led to the coup, and also then moving on into the civil war, they've been a lead force in killing ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine. The Azov Battalion runs around with swastikas. And there was even a point where the U.S. Congress, for a while, forbade the U.S. military from training the Azov Battalion and other neo-Nazis. But then, at the insistence of the Obama administration, that restriction was removed. So the United States could train the Azov Battalion, which, you know, has, you know, SS insignias on its helmets and things like. So you're talking about people that really see themselves as Nazis. So, and it's also interesting, and this has even been reported briefly in the mainstream press, but largely ignored, is that elements of the jihadist movement, jihadists who are close to the Islamic State, have actually joined with the neo-Nazis in Ukraine, incredibly, to sort of go off and kill ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine. And this is all now documented, it's all known. But it's essentially buried by the mainstream press because it doesn't really fit the narrative, the happy narrative of white hats versus black hats, or the Kiev regime is white hats and the ethnic Russians are black hats. And so that's the game that the mainstream press has played, but it's not the reality. And it's a very dangerous game to keep playing, because there was a piece we put up today at Consortium News by Jonathan Marshall, you know, an excellent, an important journalist and author,
former editor of the Oakland Tribune, yeah,
right. And he did a really important piece about how the about why Russia is actually extremely nervous about the strategic movements that the United States has been making. And this goes back to George W. Bush getting rid of the anti-ballistic missile program. This ridiculous claim that the United States has made that it's putting these missile systems in Eastern Europe to thwart the Iranian missiles, even though they don't have any. The Russians know this is aimed at them, and the danger here is that if the Russians believe that their strategic nuclear weapons system can be negated, can be destroyed by the United States, and that would open the way to a first strike against them, they are going to react accordingly. And I know, as much as we may all, you know, foam at the mouth about Putin and so forth, he is not going to let his country be put in that position. And so the reality is, and this is not just me speaking, this is people like former Defense Secretary Perry speaking, that we are closer now to a nuclear conflagration than we were during the first Cold War, because now the Russians are faced with have to decide within minutes if they see something, whether they have to react with their own nuclear strike. And we've been playing this silly game. And I know when people talk about this, we say, oh, that's alarmist, and no one should say those things. But these are the real realities that are being ignored. And frankly, President Obama, for his personal and maybe political reasons, is now escalating this game. But it's not really a game. It becomes really a question of whether the human race survives or not. And it may be fun to make fun of Vladimir Putin for not wearing a shirt or whatever we think is so horrible, but it is really a case where the future of mankind is being put on the line. And as we continue to escalate these things, and often doing so without strong factual basis, I mean, we still have not seen the evidence that the Russians both hacked these Democratic accounts and then leaked the material to WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks specifically denies that it got them from the Russians. So, and the U.S. government has still not presented that evidence. So we're now acting on the basis of supposition, perhaps, and maybe it's true. Maybe the Russians did provide this accurate information to the American people, and maybe that's a horrible thing because it undercut Hillary Clinton's campaign, but it's still not something that's been established. And it really does bear on the Obama administration, before it leaves office, to tell the truth, whatever that is, to stop playing these games of saying, well, in the future we'll release maybe some details that maybe will somehow support what we're claiming. If they know it, you know, present the evidence.
You know, Bob, and while this unfolds, the corporate press is not only wrong, but as you said and as you've written about and we've all been concerned, the corporate press want to shut up the independents. They got it wrong, and so they become sort of a McCarthyite operation in defense of State Department policy under Obama.
Yeah, we've seen that, and we've seen that escalate in the weeks since the election. We've seen attacks on Consortium News and on, you know, a number of other Counterpunch, Truth Out, Truth Dig. A number of the major independent internet sites have been attacked by the Washington Post, citing some anonymous website that claims that we're somehow part of some fake news, disinformation, propaganda network or something. And just, I think, today or in the last few days, President Obama has signed into law this new defense authorization, which includes tens of millions of dollars, I think $160 million or so, to combat what they call Russian propaganda. And what that amounts to is efforts to harass independent websites and other news outlets that aren't towing the State Department's line. If you question the State Department's propaganda, or if you even just insist that they actually prove what they're saying, you become targeted now. And tens of millions of dollars are being devoted to trying to harass and shut down independent voices to the American public. And this is being done under this larger umbrella of the new Cold War. And with the new Cold War is coming a new McCarthyism, that anyone who doesn't accept the State Department's version of reality is somehow disloyal, a traitor, a Putin puppet, or a Moscow stooge, whatever they... So we're almost getting the same language that we used to get back during the Cold War, but they're now applying it to independent news sites. So you have this, you have a very Orwellian/McCarthyistic reality that's developing here. Now, how it moves forward is obviously an interesting question, but many elements in the Congress have been determined to go ahead and start devoting not just tens of millions of dollars, but really hundreds of billions of dollars toward the new defense system, military operations of this new Cold War. So we're talking about a lot of money and a lot of power in Washington being carved up. Now, whether a Trump administration goes with that or goes against it, we don't really know, because I'm not even sure Donald Trump knows, because he doesn't seem to know exactly where he wants to go on a lot of issues. But that's going to be the challenge that's being presented. And in this case, we're not just seeing right-wing Republicans or neoconservatives on the Republican side, people like Lindsey Graham, who wants to put crippling sanctions on Russia. But we're seeing also the Chuck Schumers and many of the Democrats, the corporate Democrats, also joining in on this. So there's kind of a unity in what you might call mainstream official Washington in favor of this new Cold War, and it's developed a momentum of its own, Dennis, that it's going to be hard to steer it away, because there's so much money involved and so many careers involved that it's something that the American public will have to somehow intervene to stop it.
All right, we're going to have to leave it right there. But good reporting at consortiumnews.com. That's Robert Perry. You mentioned Jonathan Marshall. Actually, I think he was at the Oakland Tribune, and then he went over to the San Francisco Chronicle while it was still a real newspaper. And I guess he's writing independently now.
But his article is very important to read. It's entitled "Summing Up Russia's Real Nuclear Fears." At consortiumnews.com.
And he is a very fine, careful reporter. So we appreciate the work that he's doing there as well. Thanks, Bob. Bob Perry, consortiumnews.com. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Coming up next, we're going to take a look at
Haiti with Kevin Pena. But that's from Flashpoints News Magazine and product Daily Show of KPFA in Berkeley. And Robert Perry, I find him brilliant. He got a hold of he and Ray McGovern last week. And that was recorded before the sanctions. I don't know if they're assessed as crippling. And now we got the tweet about how clever Putin is from the real Donald Trump, whose name is Brumpf. So things still are going crazy. I had this idea that Ray McGovern ought to come out in retirement and take his place as a Russian analyst and do the daily briefings. He would make them entertaining for Trump or Pence. I guess Pence is the one who gets the briefs. Excuse me, I thought of something silly. 10:52. We don't have enough time to. I do have a short feature here in my bag of tricks. I guess I don't. So maybe we'll just do a bunch of music since it's New Year's Eve and all. And I have one set up. I promoted a little already, which is Church Street Ramblers. Not doing an early jazz tune, doing more of a ballad, but it's totally apropos. So, and the singer is an attorney, and she promised not to sue me for playing it, even if I excerpted it, which I don't think I need to now, but that's Nancy Livingston. I wish I could say all the names. I could say all the names of the Trad Jazz Orchestra who's doing early jazz and early evening, early. Maybe I should pull up another of their tunes. If I can get my devices to cooperate. Or maybe I should put up something from Cody Jensen. He's one of the people in Bones, Jugs, and Harmony are doing the last act at the Bonalicious, is that what it's called? New Year's celebration over at the Iron Post, which includes like Hot Iron String Band and a variety of things. Didn't ring it out late. I should have practiced for being up late tonight, but I didn't. And okay, here's the crew. Eight pieces. They have a new banjo player comes in from Bloomington, and they're still playing out on Tuesday nights, the third Tuesday of the month. They, as I mentioned, they started out as a class at Parkland, and they had the rehearsals and class on Tuesdays, and every third Tuesday they'd play out in public at the Iron Post, and they were then the Parkland Early Jazz Ensemble, and now they're the Church Street Ramblers, and they're pretty much fun. I have a conflicting meeting when it's the third Wednesday, but the meetings have shifted around, and maybe they will in the future. Actually, I have to check my calendar, come to think of it. All right, enough of this maundering on. Probably I only have time to play this now that I've... Opinions are those of the speakers, and the musical choice is the same. Do not necessarily respect or reflect or represent those of WEF Champaign Prairie Air Incorporated Station Management, Board of Directors, or WEF Associates. Progressive News coming up at the top of the hour. So, Gilly. She had a big fan club. That was from their Christmas version, but that was the New Orleans song. So, all right. Thanks for listening. Have a good time. Be safe. I saw that Lyft was offering $50 off on their free rides or something. I don't know if that's has a clause in it, but designated driver. And I don't like those ride services, but anyway, might do it once a year. It's time for the